said the teacher. Finley has drawn a picture. She gave Big Lou a typical child's drawing. A house, some trees, a sky in which a sun, human-featured and smiling, beamed down on a woman and a dog, stick figures both. The woman was wearing a dress on which a large letter L had been drawn. "That's you," said the teacher, smiling. "Finley explained it all to me." But what made the drawing unusual was that the woman in the foreground, clearly Big Lou, was surrounded by exactly the same radiant beams that emanated from the sun above her. Big Lou caught her breath.
"Me?"
"Yes," said the teacher, "and if I were you, I'd be very touched by that. He thinks of you as the sun." Big Lou felt the tears well up in her eyes.
"Père, oui, bien," she whispered.
Chapter 16. As Much Said as Was Unsaid. Each morning, Big Lou accompanied Finley to Stockbridge Primary School before walking back along Rayburn Place, across the bridge over the water of Leith, and up the gentle slope towards the gardens of Royal Circus Place. She followed the same route each day, as people so often do, crossing streets at precisely the same point each time, finding satisfaction in the routine. And it wasn't just familiar places that she saw, the same shop fronts, the same street furniture, the same cracks in the pavement. She also encountered the same people, all following their familiar routine, treading a path that they would follow month after month, year after year, until they no longer had to go to an office or a workshop or wherever it was that they earned their living. Sometimes it seemed to Lou that the world was something of a treadmill. A giant treadmill on which we all tramped for our allotted span, covering much the same ground with much the same view. She found herself wondering about the people she encountered on this daily trip. There was that man, for instance, who emerged from St. Stephen Street and paused before crossing the road opposite the floatarium. He always stood there for a few minutes before making his way to the other side, as if uncertain as to what to do. She saw him look at his watch, then check it again before he crossed the road, reluctant to cross until exactly the right moment, whatever that was, had arrived. Immanuel Kant, thought Big Lou. Immanuel Kant. She'd just read a biography of Kant, extracted from her shelf of old bookshop stock in which Kant's famous regularity had been explored at length. And if the citizens of Königsberg could set their watches according to the appearance of the philosopher on his daily walk, then Big Lou could do much the same thing with this man. Further up the hill, she sometimes found herself walking towards a man strolling down the road towards her, a man she thought of as the poet Hugh MacDiarmid, because he was on the short side, somewhat bowdy-legged, and sometimes in a kilt. Big Lou liked the kilt, but had views on those who should wear it and those who should seek some other means of making that particular cultural statement. In general, she felt that the kilt was for taller men, who could carry it off with the dignity that the garment required. Those who were of average height could wear it too, but had to be careful about their swagger. Those who were portly or vertically challenged needed to exercise discretion, and those who were bandy, or bowdy-legged, as Big Lou put it, had to think long and hard about wearing it at all if they wished to avoid looking too much like Harry Lauder. There is much to be said for the late Harry Lauder and his couthy songs, but whether he would recommend himself as a style icon was another matter. Over a period of months, this particular man had progressed from stranger to acquaintance. It had started with eye contact, and this, after a suitable interval, had led to a slight nodding of the head. A few weeks later, this had been supplemented with a smile, and finally words had converted the relationship into a speaking one.
Aye,
the man had muttered one morning as they passed one another on the pavement.
Aye,
responded Lou. That had sufficed for a further week. Although few words were used, such exchanges can be emotionally expressive. The adding of a sigh to the I, for instance, can say so much about the world and its problems. The addition of two sighs can express utter despair at the state of human affairs, just as prefacing the first I with an O can express nuanced emotions ranging from slight doubt to sophisticated cynicism, as in this exchange where the translations are parenthesized.
Aye, aye.
Good morning.
Aye.
Good morning.
Aye.
Is everything all right? Any news? The tone descending slightly at the end. I give up. I really do.
Aye.
The tone rising at the end. What's wrong? The usual issues?
Aye. Emphatic.
Yes, the same old stuff.
Ugh, aye.
Resigned. Here we go again. It's someone else's fault, as per usual. You'd think that people would... Then on to Great King Street, where she saw the same lawyer, an advocate, emerging from his door with its professional brass plate, and then beginning to walk up to Parliament House, his formal clothes contrasting with the everyday working dress of most others on their way to work. She came across this lawyer's photograph in the Scotsman one day, and read that he'd been given a public appointment. Thereafter, when she saw him, she noticed how stooped he looked, his shoulders bent under the increased burdens of office, and the cares that came with it. Big Lou wondered whether it was much different from life in Arbroath, or in any of the other small towns up and down Scotland. There were more people in the cities, of course, but within the urban centres, for all their crowds and complexities, the same small units of human activity, the villages, persisted. Out of the throngs they saw about them, people created small communities of 100 or 200, ignoring the rest. In a sense, all the others were extras, as in a film. They were there, crossing the scene, going about their business, but what really mattered was the people you actually saw, the people whose faces were familiar, whose background you understood, the people who knew the people you knew. She thought about this as she crossed Dundas Street to her coffee bar. She thought about it further as she unlocked the door and turned on the lights. As she switched on the coffee machine and gave the counter its first rub-down of the day, she wondered whether she had ever really left Arbroath and Snell Mains, or whether she carried them still within her and made a new Arbroath and Snell Mains right here in Edinburgh, amidst these tenements and cobbled streets, amidst all this finance and business and decision-making. Her first customer of the day came in. It was a young man who worked, she recalled, for the Royal Bank of Scotland. He was training for a marathon, and had told her all about it, and the exercise, he said, justified the bacon roll she made him every morning. She prepared a roll, the bacon sizzled in the frying pan. He sniffed at the air appreciatively. The roll was one of her special butteries, of the sort her aunts had been so good at making. This was what Scotland was all about, thought Lou. It was about butteries, and people who liked butteries. It was about conversations where as much was said as was unsaid. It was about special ways of breaking the heart. Chapter 17. At Big Lou's. When Matthew went over to Big Lou's for his morning coffee, he either left Pat in charge of the gallery, if it was one of her days to be there, or he locked the door behind him, putting up a note that said, "Back in 15 minutes, or thereabouts, depending." This wording had always amused Pat.
"It's a bit odd to say depending," she remarked. "People will think you're indecisive. Not that you are, of course. You aren't, if you see what I mean."
"But it's true," replied Matthew. "What it says is true. What we think will happen always depends on all sorts of things. And we can't be sure whether those things will happen or not happen, if you see what I mean."
Pat thought about this.
Yes, human affairs were uncertain. Yes, matters didn't always work out as we hoped they would work out. But surely we couldn't go through life qualifying everything like this.
"So should an airline say the flight to wherever will leave at 3 p.m. or whatever, depending?"
Yes,
said Matthew, because it does depend. And that, if I may say so, Pat, is a good example. The departure of any plane often does depend on all sorts of things. Whether there's a plane, for a start. You know how airlines cancel flights if they don't have a plane available. They do that, you know. It really does depend. They call it operational reasons. No plane? Operational reasons. No pilot to fly it? Operational reasons. But that's implicit. Matthew shook his head. No, it's not. People think that 3 p.m. means 3 p.m. They're funny that way. Pat laughed. I'd never call you a pedant, Matthew, but... He looked injured. I'm sorry. No need to apologize, he said. It's just that I think people should be, well, a bit more honest. We don't like being told half-truths or being lied to. People can tell, you know. They know when they're being lied to. Politicians find that out eventually. He looked at Pat. Matthew liked to read history. He liked to watch television programs about the Second World War. He was interested in Churchill, but he wasn't sure whether Pat would know anything about all that. There were plenty of people who seemed to have only the vaguest idea about the Second World War, and Pat, for all he knew, might be one of them. She knew about Giotto, of course, and Raphael, and Bonnard, and Vuillard, and so on, but did she know much about Churchill? Churchill told the truth, he said. He told people what lay ahead. He said that he had nothing to offer them but blood, sweat, and tears. He was a politician. Can you think of any politician, any, who would say that to people these days? I've got bad news for you. You're going to have to work harder, for longer, and have less money to spend. Who would say that? Name one. Well, they may not actually say it, said Pat, but there are degrees of willingness to come clean. Some are more prepared to say that sort of thing than others. But they won't say it directly, said Matthew. They won't say it outright, because people won't vote for people who say it's going to be tough. They just won't. They vote for whoever says they're going to get free sandwiches for life. You tell people that, and boy, do they like you. That morning, he knew that Pat would probably arrive while he was out at Big Lou's for coffee, but he nonetheless hung the conditional notice, the honest notice, as he called it, on the door and crossed the road to Big Lou's. Pat had a key to the gallery and could let herself in. "This place smells of bacon," said Matthew, sniffing at the air as he entered. Lou, who was polishing the gadget, turned around. "It may have something to do with the fact that I sell bacon rolls, Matthew." Matthew laughed. "I'm not saying it's a bad smell, Lou. In fact, it's one of the best smells there is, as far as I'm concerned. The smell of the forbidden." "Bacon rolls? Who's forbidding you from eating bacon rolls?" "Elspeth," said Matthew. "She says they're bad for you." "Och, away with all that," said Lou. "What's wrong with bacon? I know plenty of people who eat bacon every day of their lives. My Uncle Willie, for example. He had 3 large rashers every morning, 2 fried eggs and 3 rashers of bacon, after his porridge, of course." "What happened to him?" asked Matthew. Lou looked surprised. "What happened to him? Uncle Willie? He's dead." Matthew smiled. "Well, there you are. He's dead. But not from bacon rolls," said Lou quickly. "The tractor ran him over." Matthew made an effort to look solemn. "I'm sorry. That had nothing to do with bacon, obviously. There were all sorts of hazards in living on those northeast farms. Not only tractors, but the cold, for example. People probably froze to death up there. Certainly they did in Aberdeen." "I'm not saying that you shouldn't listen to these people telling you what to eat," said Lou. "All I'm saying is that you shouldn't worry too much. Look at eggs. We were told not to eat eggs, and now they're saying we should. Well, I carried on eating eggs all the way through. Now they're all right again. Eggs are good. Vitamin D or something." "In the yolk," said Matthew. "Eggs have vitamin D in their yolks." "And we don't have enough vitamin D in us in Scotland, Lou. We're all vitamin D deficient, apparently. Just between October and March, I think, there's not enough sun for us to make the vitamin D we need.
He paused.
I've got an idea for you, Lou. I've got an idea how you could help improve Scotland's health.
I'm not taking bacon rolls off the menu.
Oh, no, it's nothing to do with that.
Because there'd be an awful lot of people who'd feel pretty sad if I did that, continued Lou.
You can carry on serving bacon, said Matthew, but how about putting a touch of vitamin D in your coffee? It wouldn't have to be much, apparently. We each need only 10 micrograms a person a day. Put it in the coffee you serve, then we'd get it that way. Simple.
Big Lou looked at him.
Are you serious?
Matthew nodded. It would help. It could be your contribution.
Big Lou looked thoughtful.
I don't like the thought of all those folk being vitamin D deficient.
Well, you can do something about it, Lou.
Maybe.
Lou served Matthew his coffee. He looked down at it. Trust, he thought. We take so much on trust. People give us things to eat and drink, and we trust them. We have no idea what may be in the things before us, but we proceed on the basis of trust.
Is there anything in my coffee, Lou?
He asked. Big Lou smiled at him.
Bromide, she said.
Chapter 18. Watsonian Ejected. When Matthew returned to the gallery after 20 minutes at Big Lou's, he found Pat reading at her desk. He glanced at the book.
"Anything interesting?" he asked.
"It's just something I picked up. There was a book sale at Holy Corner. They had all sorts of stuff."
Matthew tried to look over Pat's shoulder, but she turned the book over, unhelpfully exposing the back cover.
"All sorts of stuff," he echoed. "I love those sales. I go to that one in George Street. They get thousands and thousands of books each year, all sold in a good cause. Lots of the books are quite new. I bought Guy Peplow's book on Samuel Peplow there last year."
"Yes," said Pat. "My father gave me a copy of that."
Matthew decided to be direct.
"So, what's this book you're reading?"
He hesitated, as one had to be careful with Pat.
"You seem a bit defensive, if I may say so. You aren't reading that 50 Shades, are you?"
Pat gave him a withering look.
"Do you think I'd read something like that?"
Matthew shrugged. "A lot of people seem to have read it. Nobody I know, of course, but..." Pat looked at him scornfully.
"I was only joking," said Matthew, smiling. "Chacun a son goût," he said.
He was open-minded, but he blushed at the memory of something that had happened to him. He'd seen the controversial book in a bookshop and had taken a furtive look inside. Unfortunately, a woman had come up to reach for another title from the shelf immediately in front of him, and Matthew couldn't replace the book without her seeing it. What would she think of him if she saw him flicking through the pages of 50 Shades? It hardly bore thinking about. She would think he was one of those people who went into bookshops and flicked through the pages of the latest salacious offerings until the staff eventually rumbled what was going on and asked them to leave. The shame of it! The public humiliation! He imagined the headline in the evening news, "Watsonian Ejected from City Store." They would be sure to mention that he was a Watsonian, because they would want to make the most of that. No, that's absurd, he thought. Nobody cares any more what other people read. Prudery and disapproval are things of the past, even in Edinburgh. And then, in a moment of heart-stopping awfulness, he recognized the woman standing beside him at the shelf. It was Mrs. Patterson Cowie, his old English teacher from Watson's. She it was who had introduced him, as a boy of 10, to Robert Louis Stevenson's A Child's Garden of Verses and to Kidnapped. From A Child's Garden of Verses to books about, well, about the sort of things 50 Shades was about. Not that Matthew imagined that anybody actually did any of the things described in such books. Why would they? Perhaps these were people who had nothing better to do? For a few moments, an eternity in his mind, Matthew remained immobile. It could hardly be worse, he thought. Or it could be, perhaps.
It could have been the moderator of the General Assembly of the Church of Scotland standing next to him. The moderator would turn to him and say, "I'm so disappointed in you, young man," or worse still, say nothing but register his disappointment in his look. And Matthew would blush deep red and mumble, "I'm doing research, you see, or perhaps, I thought this book was about interior decorating. It's very misleading, don't you think, to call a book 50 Shades of Grey, when it's not about interior decoration at all?" The moderator would agree, but then he might say, "But what is it about?" That would be problematic. He decided he had to act. Mrs. Patterson Cowie gave no sign of recognizing him. He thought that perhaps she hadn't actually seen his face. That was a relief. He could now sidle away from her, taking the book with him, and she would be none the wiser. He took a step backwards. She was still preoccupied with her scrutiny of the shelves and paid no attention to him. He took another step, but found that he couldn't retreat any further in that particular direction, as his way was blocked by a display stand for a new cookery book. Nor could he move to the left, where a door said, "Staff only." Well, that did not apply to emergencies, of which this was one. He could go through that door, wait until the coast was clear, and then emerge once more to replace the book where he'd found it. He edged sideways towards the door. He kept his face turned away from Mrs. Patterson Cowie as he pushed the handle. It gave easily, and the door swung open. He did not turn around to see if she had noticed him. Matthew found himself in a corridor, empty apart from a few tattered pieces of paper on an old notice board. At the other end was a second door, towards which he now made his way. This second door was locked. There was a keypad beside it that would open it, but one would need a code. He tried the handle several times and even applied his shoulder to the door itself, but all egress was barred. He felt his heart begin to pound. He would have to go back the way he came. He returned to the door through which he had entered the corridor. It had locked automatically from the other side. Matthew took a deep breath. Had he missed something? There must have been a lock that had been triggered once he pushed the door open. Perhaps... He stopped. There was no point in searching for explanations of his plight. The inescapable fact was that he was trapped in a corridor that was, to all intents and purposes, a cell. He leaned against the wall. He would have to think very carefully. It seemed to him that this was some sort of emergency exit for staff, who, presumably, would have been issued with a code to get out through the second door. He looked about him. The corridor had a dusty and neglected look to it. People probably only used it during fire alarm practices. He could be there for days unless he called for help and somebody heard him. But who would hear him? He'd been in a corner of the shop, away from everything else. No. He was trapped, with only one book to read. He suddenly realized then that the walls of his cell were grey. Monotonously so. Chapter 19. An Absurd Situation. The absurdity of Matthew's situation wasn't lost on him. To be stuck in a corridor with locked doors at either end was not the sort of thing that happened in reality. Such situations were the stuff of urban myths, those hoary but readily believed tales of headless motorcyclists, vanishing hitchhikers, and axe-wielding little old ladies innocently picked up by motorists in supermarket car parks. These stories, although apocryphal, evinced a feeling of dread in the listener. And did the driver only notice the blood-stained axe after he had seen his passenger's unusually hairy wrists? Just as anyone listening to the story would feel anxiety about the outcome for Matthew. What did you do? Were you really stuck there for two whole days? Of course, such things didn't really happen. Except, thought Matthew, this really is happening. And not having heard the outcome of the story, I must decide what to do. He sat down on the floor, leaning back against the wall, and attempted to clear his mind. First of all, he thought, I have not done anything wrong, and I therefore have nothing with which to reproach myself. I have simply sought to avoid social embarrassment, which is perfectly understandable and indeed even laudable. Not only would he have been ashamed had Mrs. Patterson Cowie seen him clasping a copy of 50 Shades, but she herself could have felt embarrassed. So, at least in one view, he had acted thoughtfully and might even be congratulated for his sensitivity. But that threw no light on his options. As far as he could make out, these were: 1. To bang on the door immediately in the hope of attracting the attention of somebody who would then unlock the door. That person, however, could be Mrs. Patterson Cowie, and that would be extremely awkward. 2. To wait 10 minutes, allowing Mrs. Patterson Cowie to move to another part of the shop, then to bang loudly for attention. Or 3. To do nothing, hoping that in the fullness of time a member of staff would need to use the corridor, and would in this way end his awkward durance. He weighed these 3 options, eventually deciding upon the first. There was a possibility that his former teacher would be the one to open the door for him, but he had alighted upon a way of obviating any embarrassment that might be caused by the book. He would simply tuck it into the waistband of his trousers. It was marginally too large to fit into his pocket. He'd tried that, but it could easily be concealed under the waistband. Then, at an opportune moment, he could slip it back onto its shelf. Oh, indeed, onto any shelf. He had read somewhere that the staff of bookshops were accustomed to reshelving salacious books that had been slipped back into an innocent but incorrect place on their shelves. He rose to his feet. With the book tucked out of sight, Matthew returned to the outer door and knocked heavily 3 times. Then, feeling vaguely foolish about it, he cried out, "Anybody there?" He stopped and listened. There was complete silence. He knocked again, more loudly this time, and was on the point of shouting out once more when he heard a voice on the other side. "I'm here," said the voice. Matthew hesitated. Then he said, "Would you mind unlocking this door?" There was silence on the other side. Then at length the voice said, "Are you there?" "Yes," said Matthew. "I'm here. Are you there?" "I'm here," came the reply. "What do you want?" Matthew felt a surge of irritation. "I want you to unlock the door." He struggled to keep his voice even. He had already asked this person, whoever he was, to unlock the door. How many times would he need to make the request? "What?" asked the voice. "What do you want me to do?" "To unlock the door," said Matthew, his voice now appreciably raised. "Who are you?" asked the voice. "That doesn't matter," said Matthew. "I just want you to unlock the door." "I'm not sure if I should," said the voice. "I'm just a customer." "Oh, for heaven's sake," snapped Matthew. "Don't be so ridiculous." "There's no need to be rude," said the voice. "I'm not being rude," said Matthew, seething now. "You're the one who's being rude. Not helping somebody who's trapped is being extremely rude." "Who's trapped?" said the voice. "Oh, you complete gawk," expostulated Matthew. "I'm trapped. I'm trapped behind this door, and all you have to do is to open it." "Don't you call me a gawk," the voice retorted. "You're the gawk." "Shut up," shouted Matthew. "Just open this." And here Matthew swore. He wasn't given to swearing, but he couldn't contain himself. This was just so ridiculous and so intensely frustrating. "Don't you use that language to me," said the voice. "I'm trying to be helpful. That's the trouble with this country. It's become so foul-mouthed, people don't even realize that they're swearing." "Just open the door," Matthew pleaded. "I didn't mean to swear at you. I really didn't." "Are you going to apologize?" asked the voice. Matthew was now desperate. "Of course I'll apologize." There was the sound of another voice and a muttered conversation that Matthew couldn't hear properly. And then there was a clicking sound, and the door swung open. There, standing outside, was a man in his mid-30s, slightly corpulent, wearing a blue sweater and with an annoyed, disapproving look on his face. This was the voice with whom Matthew had conducted such a fraught conversation. Then, at his side, was the assistant manager of the bookshop, identified as such by the badge on his shirt. And finally, behind the two of them and gazing at Matthew with undisguised interest, Mrs. Patterson Cowie.
"What's been going on?" asked the assistant manager. "How'd you get in here?"
"I took a wrong turning," said Matthew.
"It says staff only," pointed out the assistant manager.
Matthew felt his cheeks turning red.
"I know, but I just did. I'm sorry."
"He said he was trapped," said the man in the blue sweater.
"Well, I was," said Matthew.
"And he used some pretty strong language," continued the man.
Mrs. Patterson Cowie looked disapproving. Matthew, though, was relieved that she appeared not to recognize him.
"Where did you go in there?" asked the assistant manager. "You weren't thinking of shoplifting, were you?"
Matthew drew in his breath sharply.
"That's what I thought," said the man in the blue sweater. "That's exactly what I thought."
"Oh, don't be so ridiculous," said Matthew.
"Then why have you got a book tucked into your waistband?" asked the assistant manager.
Chapter 20. Homo Ludens.
Pat stared at Matthew.
"You've gone bright red," she said. "Matthew, you're blushing."
Matthew, who had been leaning forward in his attempt to discern the title of Pat's book, straightened up.
"Am I really?" he mumbled. "Yes, you are. Like a tomato."
He moved away. Now he faced the window out onto Dundas Street, a favoured stance from which he occasionally attempted to dictate a letter to Pat, an endeavour that never lasted long as Pat kept correcting him as he spoke.
"Do you really want to say that? Or, they're not going to like that, you know."
How could one write a letter in the face of such interventions? How would a real businessman react to being corrected in this way by his secretary? But Pat, of course, was not a secretary, and secretaries, anyway, had ceased to exist, as far as he could make out. And not before time, thought Matthew. The whole role had been designed to keep women in a subservient position in the workforce, as handmaidens to those who did more generously rewarded work. Matthew would never subscribe to that. Pat was an assistant, or even a colleague, doing much the same work as he did, and only occasionally typing letters. But now she was gazing at him with one of those unsettling looks of hers, as if she was trying to work out what he was thinking. Real businessmen did not have to put up with that, he imagined. You did not find that sort of thing in banks and legal offices.
"I was thinking of something," Matthew explained. "And it made you blush."
He nodded. He was wary.
"Could be. A rather embarrassing situation I was in a little while ago."
She looked interested.
"Oh, yes? What?"
Matthew didn't answer immediately. It was none of Pat's business, and she shouldn't have asked him. It was rather like asking somebody who has mentioned going to the doctor what they're suffering from. One didn't do it. And it was the same with blushes, really. If somebody blushed, should you ask them what brought on the blush? He thought not.
"I was accused of shoplifting."
He would tell her that much, he decided. He needn't go into further detail.
She gasped. "No! What a dreadful experience! You know, I've often wondered what I'd do if somebody stopped me as I was leaving a shop and said, "Excuse me, madam, what have you got in that bag of yours? You know, I'd faint. I'm sure I would."
"Yes," said Matthew. "It's not pleasant."
"And had you?" asked Pat.
"What?"
She immediately corrected herself.
"Oh, no, sorry. I didn't mean to say that."
Matthew looked at her reproachfully.
"Do you think I would..."
It was her turn to blush.
"No, of course not. I don't know why I asked that. It was stupid. Of course you wouldn't."
She paused.
"Where was it?"
"In a bookshop."
She nodded.
I've got a friend who works in a bookshop. She says it's a constant problem for them. People come in and steal books. But they also read them, you know. They come in and stand for hours reading books they're never going to buy.
It must be galling for the bookshop.
Yes, and then, Pat continued, then there are people who come in and head straight for the erotica section.
Matthew stared fixedly out of the window.
Erotica? Yes, the steamy stuff. Like that book, what's it called? 50-something?
Matthew resisted the temptation to look at her. He felt the back of his neck becoming warm.
Yes, said Pat. They stand there in their dirty raincoats reading that stuff. Sometimes the staff have to ask them to leave.
Matthew said nothing.
Pat laughed. She was telling me the other day that they caught somebody with that book tucked into his trousers, red-handed, so to speak. Apparently he made a run for it. He pushed one of the customers over into a pile of recipe books, Jamie Oliver's latest. Then he ran out of the shop.
Matthew was silent. He had not intended to collide with Mrs. Patterson Cowie. It was her fault for getting in the way. And she didn't really fall. It was more of a slow topple.
But they've got it all on CCTV, Pat continued. They played it back and saw everything. His face, the works, all there.
Matthew opened his mouth.
Oh, they called the police.
Really? He sounded distant, as if whispering from somewhere afar.
Yes. And did they get him? They're working on it, said Pat. But it's difficult. The police are not all that bothered about the theft side of it, but they don't like the pushing of the customer. They say that he might be dangerous.
Dangerous?
Yes, as in those police warnings, don't approach this person. He might be dangerous.
Matthew cleared his throat.
They'll probably never catch him, he said.
Probably not, said Pat.
And anyway, she, my friend, thinks that he was just a harmless perv. He was trying to steal that book. You know, 50 Shades. Poor man. Imagine being a perv.
Matthew frowned, as if trying to imagine it.
Yes, he said.
He turned around. It was time to change the subject.
What's that book you're reading?
Pat picked it up again.
You probably know it, she said. The Eclipse of Art. It's by Julian Spaulding.
It's all about...
I know it, said Matthew.
He was relieved that they had moved on to art.
I agree with him. It's very amusing on conceptual art, about how the whole thing has become a...
She trailed off.
A blind alley, said Matthew. A banal nothing manipulated by a handful of wealthy collectors. Found objects. Decaying animal heads covered in flies. Sharks in formaldehyde. Bits of string. You should hear Angus on the subject, particularly the Turner Prize.
He despises it, doesn't he?
Yes, and he's trained Cyril to lift his leg whenever he hears the words Turner Prize.
A bit childish, said Pat.
Matthew smiled. Homo ludens. Pat looked thoughtful. She had been unable to concentrate on her book and had read the same paragraph 3 times. It was Bruce. That was the problem. She couldn't get him out of her mind, and even now, talking to Matthew, he came back to her. She arose from her desk.
Matthew, she said, I need your help.
Chapter 21 Waiting for Godot. It was unusual for Stuart and Irene Pollock to go out to dinner. In fact, as Stuart made his way home from work that evening, he tried to remember the last occasion on which they had gone out together, and initially failed. It was only when he was walking the last few hundred yards through Drummond Place that he recalled their dinner together shortly before the birth of Ulysses. It had not been a success. They'd gone to an Italian restaurant that had recently attracted good reviews, but where, at an early stage of proceedings, Irene had fallen out with the waiter. This was a result of her correcting his pronunciation of some of the specials on offer that night,
an intervention that had not gone down well, and not surprisingly, as the waiter was Italian. Matters hadn't improved after that. Waiters enjoy a very particular form of power, and are capable of revenge in more ways than one. Some of these acts of revenge may be overt, in the form of delaying service, with exquisite judgment as to the precise delay that can be achieved without causing diners to abandon their meal altogether. Others may be more indirect. Food may be oversalted between kitchen and table, may be put out to cool. Orders may be so easily confused or deprived of a vital element. All of this falls short of that ultimate sanction at the waiter's disposal, spitting in the soup. This is a sufficiently distasteful sanction to be vigorously denied by those who speak on behalf of waiters, but they all know that it occurs. Since that outing, there had been very few occasions in their mutual social calendar. There had been one or two functions at the school where they had joined other parents at events of one sort or another, but these two had not been conspicuous successes. One of the school plays had in fact been chosen and directed by Irene. The Class 2 production of Waiting for Godot had not been well received, as Stuart had predicted as tactfully as he could. It was all very well for Irene to claim that she had rewritten Beckett's script to make it more approachable for young actors, but Stuart felt there was a fundamental problem in choosing a play in which only two actors dominate the stage. Irene had sighed. "But that, Stuart," she said, "is the whole point about Godot. It's very intense, even to the point of unbearability."
"Yes," said Stuart, "I find it unbearable. The whole second act is unbearable. It goes on and on. Even your version, Irene, I'm afraid, seems to go on and on."
Sensing her reaction, he quickly corrected himself.
I mean it goes on and on a bit. Not all that much, I suppose. But I just wonder whether this is quite the right play for 7-year-olds. Just a thought, Irene."
Irene made a dismissive noise. It was one of those dismissive noises that French are so good at. They say pouf, or bof, or pa, with such style that one can be under no illusions as to the fact that whatever is being dismissed is beneath contempt, and certainly not worthy of explicit refutation.
"When I say it's unbearable," she explained, "I mean the tension is unbearable. That's what makes it such a powerful piece of drama."
So Godot had been chosen and casting had begun. That proved to be a minefield, even if it was a minefield through which Irene sailed, blissfully unaware of the dangers lurking below the surface. Miss Campbell, the class teacher, had willingly handed the class over to Irene towards the end of a school day, going off for a much-needed cup of tea in the staff room.
"Bertie's mummy will be talking to you about this term's exciting play," she announced. "She will be what is called the director. Now, children, is there anybody who knows what a director does?"
Olive's hand had gone up, and was with reluctance recognized by Miss Campbell.
"Well, Olive dear, tell us what a director does." "Orders people about," said Olive.
"Hits them," suggested Larch. Miss Campbell smiled blithely.
"Not quite. A director helps the actors to do what is required. The director gets the whole show going, like the conductor of an orchestra."
With that established, she left the classroom, and Irene began to discuss the play.
"Waiting for Godot is by a very famous Irish writer called Samuel Beckett," she said. "He wrote a lot in French, but we shall be doing the play in English, which is the only language that most of you speak. Apart from Bertie, of course. It's all about two men who are waiting to meet somebody called Godot."
Tofu's hand went up. Irene did not like Tofu. She'd never approved of him, suspecting him, correctly, of holding exactly those attitudes from which she wished to shield Bertie. She made an effort to be polite,
Yes, Tofu. Have you something to say about Beckett?
I'll play him, said Tofu. I'll be Godo.
Irene hesitated. It was irresistible. What a delicious thought. Tofu waiting for his role and then discovering that Godo never comes.
What a good idea, Tofu. Yes, you can be Godo.
Tofu sat back in his seat, smirking with self-satisfaction. Olive didn't approve.
That's not fair, Mrs. Pollock. Why should Tofu be Godo when there are lots of much better actors in the class? Bertie could be Godo.
Shut your face, Olive, muttered Tofu.
Did you hear what he said to me?
Protested Olive.
He told her to shut her face, Mrs. Pollock, chimed in Pansy. He's always telling people to shut their faces. He doesn't deserve to be Godo.
Perhaps he does, thought Irene. She pressed ahead regardless.
And there are two other very big roles, Estragon and Vladimir.
Stupid names, said Larch.
Irene ignored this.
I think that Bertie should be Estragon.
Bertie squirmed. He'd been afraid that his mother would choose him. Of course she would.
Must I? He said in a pleading tone. Must I really? He doesn't want to do it, crowed Olive. Did you hear what he said, Mrs. Pollock? Let me be Estragon.
That's a boy's name, stupid, said Tofu. Estragon's a boy, isn't he, Mrs. Pollock?
And so the casting had continued, as had the play. Unfortunately, the actual performance hadn't been a success, as only the parents of the children appearing in the play came, offence having been taken over the choice of a play with only two characters. Irene had, at the last minute, eliminated the minor characters from her script. This had led to a boycott by the other parents, and an audience consisting only of Stuart and Irene and Hiawatha's mother, Hiawatha having been cast as Vladimir.
I thought that went remarkably well, observed Irene as they made their way home after the performance.
Stuart was silent, as was Bertie. Chapter 22. At the Carl Gustav Jung Drop-In Center. Since that testing evening at the school, Stuart and Irene had not gone out together. There was no deliberate decision to remain at home, it just seemed to work out that way. Irene had a busy schedule, what with her Melanie Klein book group, her other book group, her Pilates sessions, her East Newtown Community Council outreach evenings, and her commitments as a volunteer counsellor at the Edinburgh Carl Gustav Jung Drop-In Centre. The last of these, which involved her going out every Tuesday and Wednesday evening for 3 hours, was a commitment that Stuart would dearly have loved her to drop, but she resolutely stuck by it. In Stuart's view, the Carl Gustav Jung Drop-In Centre should have been closed a long time ago on the grounds that even if people dropped in, most of them soon dropped out. This was because the centre, which passers-by imagined dispensed soup and coffee and handouts of various sorts, in fact was there principally to provide Jungian counselling, including advice on the meaning of dreams. A typical evening at the centre involved two counsellors waiting several hours for a member of the public to drop in. If anybody did, then he or she would be allocated to a counsellor on a strict rotation basis. After a few minutes, it would become apparent whether or not the dropper-in was prepared to accept counselling. Almost always the answer to this was unambiguous and became evident through the attitude of the potential client. Misunderstandings were frequent, as in this exchange. Member of the Great Edinburgh Public.
Sure, I take my coffee white. Two sugars. Make it three.
Counsellor.
Ha! Coffee! Well, this is not exactly that sort of drop-in centre.
MGEP.
So what do you do then? Shoop. I wouldn't mind a bowl of something hot and nourishing. Ken what I mean?
Counsellor.
Ha! No, we don't do soup, I'm afraid. What about your dreams?
MGEP.
My dreams. You joking, pal?
Counselor, Carl Gustav Jung was a Swiss psychologist who... MGEP.
You think I need a psychologist?
Counselor,
I didn't say that. That's for you to decide. We are here simply to provide support for those who do.
I didn't say you did. What about your dreams, anyway?
MGEP. Mind your own business. I'll tell you one thing and I'll tell you three. I'm out of here.
That sort of thing happened distressingly frequently, as the drop-in centre was in a run-down building rather close to two popular pubs on the eastern fringes of the eastern New Town, and therefore virtually on Leith Walk, which was, to use Jungian terminology, a whole different ballgame. With all these commitments, Irene found no time to go out with Stuart, even though Stuart's mother, Nicola, was still living just around the corner in Northumberland Street and had declared her willingness to babysit whenever required. Irene thanked her in the icily polite tone she always used with Stuart's mother and said that she would think about it.
Possibly some time, she said, adding, perhaps. We'll see.
No casting agency, faced with a talentless hopeful, had ever issued so clear a rejection, and, quite understandably, Nicola had taken offence.
"Most mothers," she said to Stuart, by which I suppose I mean most normal mothers, "would jump at an offer of a babysitting from a grandmother. But I must remind myself that we are not dealing here with a normal mother. No offence meant, Stuart, and I hope none taken. But that is an observation that I feel compelled to make."
Stuart had mumbled some excuse on Irene's behalf, but even he knew that he sounded less than convincing.
"She has a lot on her plate these days," he said. "There are problems at her yoga class."
Nicola looked dismissive.
"Problems at her yoga class? Now that's something to think about. I suppose some people might find themselves twisted into a position out of which they can't escape. I suppose some of them might be left there for hours while the instructors endeavour to disentangle them. Oh, yes, I can imagine that problems at a yoga class would weigh very heavily on anybody's mind."
"Mother," said Stuart, "please, please, there's no need to adopt that tone. You have to understand that..."
Nicola, who had shown great patience over the years, erupted.
"Oh, I understand, Stuart. I understand very well indeed. I understand that you have married an 84-horsepower, 6-cylinder, fuel-injection, turbocharged cow."
"Mother,"
protested Stuart, but Nicola was in full stride.
"No, let me finish. Let me tell you how it breaks my heart. Breaks my heart to see my son under the thumb of that selfish, opinionated woman with her Melanie Klein nonsense and her relentless denigration of men. Do you think I don't see it? Do you think I don't say to myself every day, Stuart, oh, I wish my son had the mettle to stand up to that ghastly wife of his? And then I find myself thinking, oh, if only my son would just go out and have an affair, not a pathetically insipid attempt like last time, but a full-blooded, passionate affair with all the bells and whistles, and with a woman who doesn't diminish him at every step, who doesn't set out to neuter him, who doesn't subject him and my grandsons to a barrage of politically correct claptrap, with a woman who would cherish him rather than undermine him. Oh, I wish the day would dawn when he would just stand up to her and push her into the water of Leith or something like that. Not a deep part, of course, but just a bit at the edge."
"Mother, how can you say such things? How can you?"
Nicola was undeterred.
"Very easily, Stuart, and with utter conviction, because that is exactly what I wish and what I know in my heart of hearts I shall never get. And that heroic little boy, Bertie, is going to have to continue to put up with a mother who, to all intents and purposes, is a cross between Carl Gustav Jung and a Stasi officer."
"Oh, Mother, come on. That's a bit extreme, surely."
You say a bit extreme, Stuart. Only a bit. So that means you see at least some truth in what I'm saying. And yet you let this situation continue. You let it go on and never, never do anything to stop it.
She looked at her son. Now she felt sorry for him and sighed.
Oh, darling, she said, can't you see what's going on? I know you're a lovely, nice man and you don't like conflict, but can't you see what's happening?
Chapter 23 Stuart Reflects. He reached the top of Scotland Street and paused to look down the sharp fall of the road. Edinburgh was built on hills, on ridges of rock. If the land were the sea, then these ridges were like the spines of whales, or dolphins, perhaps, protruding from the surface. George Street was one such spine from which the land fell away to the north, and Scotland Street was part of that decline. It was a much wider street than many of the neighbouring streets, which gave it the feeling, Stuart had realised, of a courtyard that was not quite a courtyard, yet could so easily be one if the street were closed off at either end. His friend from university days, Neil, who was an architect, had explained to him once that people feel happiest living in a courtyard-type arrangement because they felt secure. "People like to face other people," he said. "It's as simple as that. Put them in a long line and they feel uneasy. Long lines aren't friendly."
"So houses in a row are... what? Uncomfortable?"
"Yes," said Neil. "Go to any one suburban street, where there's a long line of houses, and ask people if they know their neighbours. They may know the people on either side of them, but probably not those living three or four houses along."
Stuart thought of Scotland Street. He knew or recognised just about everybody in their part of the street, and that included those on the other side.
Neil was warming to his theme.
"Have you ever been in an American bar?"
Stuart had been to a statistical conference in America when he'd been studying for his aborted PhD. That had been in Bloomington, Indiana, but he had spent several days in New York on his way there. He had been in a bar, he seemed to recall, but he didn't remember the details.
"Well," said Neil, "people sit in a line along the bar, all facing the bartender. It's very difficult to talk to somebody sitting beside you if that person's facing the same way as you are. And three people in that arrangement can't hold a conversation involving all three of them, unless the one in the middle strains to sit back while the other two strain to sit forward." He paused. "And the result? Loneliness. Isolation. Enemy."
"The same with housing?"
"Yes," said Neil. "Modernist architecture loved big shapes but forgot about people. It erected buildings which paid no attention to people's psychological needs. Those great blocks of flats out at Sight Hill, the ones they've now blown up, or the flats they put people into when they took them out of the Gordles. No shared space. No connection with the people around you, nor with the landscape. Nothing. Just enforced loneliness."
"And the loneliness went further," Neil continued. "Not only were people made to feel lonely, but the new buildings themselves had an imposed loneliness, so to speak, because they themselves, the buildings, were designed not to talk to their surrounding buildings. In the past," Neil smiled, "am I sounding old-fashioned? Am I sounding like one of those people who grumble on about new buildings?"
"Like Prince Charles?"
Neil laughed. "The thing about Prince Charles is that even if he may not be right about everything, there are things that he really is right about. People snipe at him and condescend to him. But if you look at what he actually says about the world about us, he's often right. He's right about climate change, and he's right about the arrogance of some architects and the people behind them. He's absolutely right when he goes on about architectural brutalism, about buildings that ignore where they are and just want to make some great ostentatious statement, or don't care about anything, including statements, and just want to be as big and as brutally functional as they like. And that's all about money, isn't it?
about making money without any regard to the effect that your actions will have on the lives of others. Look at China.
China?
Yes. All they're interested in is making money.